RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
As a child, Neisha Crosland was quiet and shy, with a passion for drawing in minute detail, mainly due to her short-sightedness. So it was inevitable that she would take a creative path. But she was dissuaded from fine art by her father, who favoured something more commercial, and Neisha found herself at Camberwell School of Art studying graphic design. But while on a field trip to the V&A, she took a wrong turning to be confronted by the rich textures and bold patterns of some 16th century Ottoman Empire textiles. It was a eureka moment for her, and a moment that changed the course of her career and life. After completing a postgraduate course at the Royal College of Art, she spent 8 years absorbing the hard-nosed world of textile manufacturing, punctuated by success and frustration in equal measures. But in 1997, with financial support from her partner and mother, she took the plunge and started her own company, where she could at last have total control over the process of her creations. Over the next 15 years, she built up a highly enviable position in the world of textile design, with her work being licensed to many household products, from fabrics to wallpaper and rugs to ceramics. We spoke at her brand new purpose-built studio in South London. We started by talking about that special moment at the Victoria and Albert Museum nearly a quarter of a century ago.
I thought I wanted to be a painter, and my father was incredibly strict and said, no, you can't, and I won't let you go to art school unless you do something that you're going to come out with some sort of qualification that's going to enable you to get a job. So I chose graphics at Camberwell, which was very fine art biased at the time. And when I went round, I could see lots of paint and life drawing and things. So I thought, well, this might be all right. So we had a project that we did, which was illustrating a short story. It was a Dylan Thomas short story. And I built it up with lots of cards, so it was very three-dimensional. And the tutor said to me, oh, you know, very, very nice, but actually, you know, this has got to be printed flat, so you've got to translate that 3D effect. And you've also got to choose a typography to go with the story. And I thought, oh, damn, you know, I like it as it is. And although very interested in typography in that, you know, like anything that looks beautiful and appreciated that, but wasn't really interested in actually making it happen. Then there was a lecture we all went to at the V&A Museum on William Morris's Kelmscott Press. And I was late. I arrived at the museum late and got lost on my way to the lecture theatre, but found myself in front of the Ottoman Empire sort of textiles, these early textiles, which are sort of circa 15, 16 something, you know, century. And they were incredibly bold. They were these, some of them were just dots actually in repeat on, you know, beautiful kind of brocaded silks and velvets, and in fact in many different ways. And there were these sort of Chintamani wheels, which are these wheels with sort of very spokes coming out of them, and sort of a lip thing and a crescent and tulips, but all very simple and very sort of bold and stark. And I thought they were fantastic, and they look so modern. And I really loved the way that they were all done in different techniques as well, and different colours. So they all had different moods according to the way that they were produced and coloured. And I thought that was fascinating. At the time, I was really, really interested in the Russian avant-garde. And there was an exhibition at the Royal Academy, I think in the would have been in the 70s, I was late 70s probably, George Kostakis' collection of Russian avant-garde art. And I remember being bowled over by, you know, a particular, a lot of female artists, which was really powerful stuff from Popova and Goncharova and Stepanova, and of course all the Malevich and Tatlins and things. And I just thought they were fantastic. And it was in fact seeing those that made me not feel so bad about not painting, because I thought I could never go further than them anyway. But these Ottoman textiles had that same kind of that fact that they were so bold and simple, and so, you know, the bare essentials were there to make a huge impact.
So were you just at that time on a sort of foundation course, or had you a degree?
I'd done my foundation.
Done your foundation.
It was my first year degree.
So you'd actually found your way during foundation to want to pursue graphics.
Well, but with a sort of. The only reason why I did it was because I really wanted to paint. I saw myself more as a fine artist, but because of the pressure
you got
from my father, and also the feeling that at the time, actually, you have to be bloody tough to be a painter and a fine artist. And, you know, I just thought, no way, I'm not, I want children and family. You know, I'm not going to be as single-minded. And the Russian avant-garde people completely, I thought, well, they've gone, you know, I mean, I don't think I can contribute anything. I'll be a Sunday painter if I want to, you know, it'll happen. But it was in front of these Ottoman textiles that I realised absolutely for sure I was doing the wrong course.
Right.
It was clear as I had dreaded a religious vocation that was promised to me when I was at school. I went to a convent and they all said, you know. So it felt like, oh, thank God, it's, you know, it was absolutely, completely clear. So I turned around and got on the bus back to Camberwell and storming into the principal's office, who was having a meeting with, I remember, lots of men in suits, and said, I've made a mistake. I need to be doing textiles.
And they accepted that? And...
Yeah, they said, well, you need to drop out now and come back next year, the beginning of the year. You know,
right.
I was sort of halfway through the first year.
Yes.
So I did a... I then thought, okay, well, maybe I'll get a job, and I'll get a job in somewhere that does textiles. And I went to Laura Ashley selling fabric, thinking that maybe I could make my way up into the studio, at least, you know, for a summer holiday job, or maybe forever, you know. And, of course, got my numbers all wrong. Going back to what we were talking about before we started this, you know, when Mrs. Whoever comes in wanting a round, you know, got a round table with a
she
prop.
Got 7 metres instead of... Oh, dear. Well, while we're on that, let's whiz back to your childhood. What were you like as a child?
I remember drawing from a very early age, and I remember, my first memory ever was colour, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Coloured, my parents had these dark brown walls and these coloured cigarettes. I think they were Ralph Smith's Sobrani cocktail cigarettes.
Yeah, very beautiful.
They were beautiful. Yeah, and they had a gold tip.
Yeah.
So my clear memory is this dark chocolate brown, this wonderful coloured cigarettes with gold band. And I must have been about three after three. So I might have even been two, actually. I mean, but it's a very clear memory.
Right.
And then I was quite very shy. We were three of us, a year between us, three girls. My parents divorced. And so I wouldn't say that childhood was a happy thing.
No.
So I took great refuge in drawing.
Right.
And I was incredibly short-sighted, which I didn't realise till I was nine. And I could see things really well close up, the myopic, and not at all. You know, it was all a blur from about, you know, sort of 20 centimetres beyond my nose. It was all a bit of a blur. So I used to do these incredibly detailed drawings, really fine, and with these rotring pens. Do you remember those? That's all I wanted for a birthday and Christmas was, you know, the scratchiest, I mean, all you know, from thick right down to thin. And I remember the thinnest one was like a sort of tiny little sharp needle, wasn't it?
So you would be what age then?
The rotring penning would have been about aged 10.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know. I always thought that was quite interesting, that I was always interested in this fine drawing. And so I would start drawing things like the veins on leaves. I would love doing things like the maps in geography and biology, where you could do the rotating pen would come out.
Very interesting if you think about that, because that sort of thing reoccurs in your work a lot. I mean, nature and organic shapes and detail.
Detail, yes. And then my grandfather had this, he had a... He was a heart surgeon, and he had these Culpeper herbals, but the herbals.
I do,
And he had all these lovely leather-bound books with illustrations of herbs, and so I used to copy those. I mean, literally just copy them. So I suppose then I was about, how old was I, maybe 10? So I used to copy these, just the idea was just to copy.
Yep.
You know, I wasn't trying to do anything particularly creative.
Yeah.
I was just copying. So that, I remember doing. I remember doing a lot of marbling for the mounts. I used to frame them, and that was quite fun, because that was like sort of Jackson Pollock. You could sort of throw, thing on this mixture of builder's size, and I love the contrast of the fine spin and then the, you know, hair down thing.
With your parents, you know, before, obviously, they parted company. Were they in any way creative?
My mother was incredibly... Yes, she was, and she is. She was a stylist for Harper's, and she then went on to work with Hugh Hudson and Ridley Scott.
Oh, really?
When they did commercials.
Yes, I know.
She did the wardrobes.
So she would have worked on probably the Hovis commercial.
On the Hovis one, on the After Eights one,
yes.
And the Nescafe.
Yes.
And, she did the Hovis, yeah.
Wow, well, yeah, which is still talked about.
Yeah, and the After Eight ones,
right,
she did.
Right, okay.
And then she went back to art school, actually, to do... she married Roald Dahl. So she was incredibly stylish,
yes,
my mother.
Yes.
I mean, she would always remember at school, she'd come to Parents' Day, and
right.
I'd be really embarrassed, but she'd be in this amazing Jean Muir knickerbockers and sort of studded boots and things, and incredibly beautiful and glamorous. And so I suppose I was sort of had that going on around me. And not that I ever felt particularly glamorous or anything, but she was glamorous,
sure.
and you know, and stylish, and decorated houses very well, and all of that. Anyway, when she met Roald, he couldn't stand her being in the film business, you know, and it was a tough job,
yeah.
You know, on location and things, and three children. So she went back to City and Guild and did restoration and carving and gilding. So then I got introduced to sort of Grinling Gibbons and Matthias Locke and talk of all of that, and absolutely loved the drawing in it, you know, the drawing aspect of it, and how the drawing translated into three-dimensional, which of course pattern always does in the end, and this is always wrapped around something. So I think that sort of thing was starting, you know, to kick in, and I would have been about, how old was I then? I was probably about 17 then.
So that's there's a clear sort of formulation for what was to come later. So you then go off to, you obviously do a foundation, you then go on to Camberwell and you switch over.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads you to a postgraduate course at the Royal College of Art.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that, because that's a big sort of change when you sort of decide to go on a postgraduate course, where you really sort of... zeroing in on a particular area that you really
right.
want to...
I know, it was a difficult period, actually. That first year was really hard. At Camberwell, you see, there was a lot of focus on mixing up your dyes and crushing beetles and you know, you learned... You even made your own gum arabic to put
yeah.
the cloth on the table in your own screens.
In the kind of William Morris kind
absolutely.
Of way.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And it was in... But you, as you... You're right, because, you know, each week there was a programme, you know.
Yeah.
So this week we'll do, you know, wood block, block cutting, and next week we'll do...
So you felt guided,
so
because when you get
structured.
To the Royal College,
yeah,
it's
you're
a
not,
little...
There's no structure.
You're very much
exactly.
left to your own...
But I think because I had done all that at Camberwell and knew I was in control of my craft...
Yeah.
So... I didn't need anybody by the time I got to, from the craft point of view.
Right.
Because we had a really, the technician was just, I mean, we won't go into that.
Right.
But he was shut in his cupboard most of the time. And so I had that. But also at Camberwell, I had learnt the importance of repeat and the whole thing of how really what textiles, and I still, the thing that fascinates me most is that it's a modular, it's something that's just put into repeat, and it's a bit like, it's music with notes. It's a stringing together of motifs, and you create a rhythm and a pattern, etc.
Yep.
However, when I went to Royal College, I was very lost, because I'd done a lot of drawing at Camberwell, and I hadn't quite got into the pattern making thing. I just learned about the idea that it was, you know, this block cutting thing, but I still had this idea that I was still a bit of a fine artist,
mm-hmm.
and I found it really hard to let go of that. So I'd fiddle around to my heart's content, because nobody else was on the print tables, because nobody else knew how to, unless you'd come from Camberwell, you didn't know how to mix your own dyes. So I wasn't reliant, so I had available to me, so it was just when Jocelyn Stevens had just come in his first year there.
Yeah.
So the cuts hadn't happened.
Yeah.
So I had available to me acres, well, I mean, you know, feet and feet of print tables, and Bunsen burners and, you know, jars of different chemicals and dyes, and a lab to myself.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time just experimenting with dye stuff and textures and things, but I hadn't quite got onto the pattern making thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what kicked in for me was it was the Renaissance. It was the medieval. I went to Venice on a travel scholarship, and went to St. Mark's Cathedral, and went to... I got a book, actually. It was the book that I bought there more than anything. that had a lot of, you know, the ecclesiastical cloaks, which were chasubles and things. Yeah. And the incredible patterns on those, and then Fortuny as well. Mm-hmm. So Fortuny had a lot of texture going on. So I had all my velvet texture things that I was doing, and then these bold shapes, and then harking back to the Ottoman, and I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, and the block cut thing that I did at Campbell, and Baron and Larcher I was looking at, and the idea that actually it's actually all very simple. Mm. It's a simple shape, put into repeat, you just have to get the right shape, and you have to repeat it in the right way. So that's when I took off. It was in halfway through my last year.
And in the, I think in your final year, your final show, that led you to producing a collection for Osborne Little.
Exactly. The collection I did at my show, the degree show, was very much based on the scholarship, or the influences, the inspirations from Venice, the Fortuny, the St. Mark's Cathedral, the gold, a lot of gold brocade faded, and of course, because it wasn't new, it was, you know. So I did a collection on old velvet curtains that I got from Brick Lane, where I print layers and layers of colour, gold, sandwiches. I mean, I'd do a layer of white pigment, a layer of another colour, whatever, blue, green, doesn't matter. I mean, and then layer it up, so you'd have layers and layers of different pigment, and then I'd bung them in the washing machine at home, so it all cracked, and the velvet all cracked. Mm. So it kind of looked a bit like, sort of simulated those old brocades that I'd fallen in love with. And then I was doing a lot of Devore as well, and then putting the pigment behind the cloth of the Devore, so you got things coming through, and then printing on the back of velvet, so you got a holographic effect. I was trying to do as much as I possibly could. What I discovered was that just with one fabric and with one set of screens, i.e. one pattern, what you could do with different techniques.
Yes.
You could spend, months on just a dot, if you like, if you're given all these different fabrics and techniques. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yes.
And that's those orange boxes upstairs.
I see. Your archive.
That was after I left the Royal College.
Moving on to that, there was a kind of an eight-year, post the Royal College, there was an eight-year period where I suppose you were... you were working for, quite a number of different organisations, kind of finding your feet, really.
Yes, well, because Osborne Little, what happened, Osborne Little came, I mean, I was really lucky, they came to my show on the first hour of the first day, and said, we want you to convert your collection into a commercial collection under our guidance. So I was put in the corner at Osborne Little, given complete carte blanche by Anthony Little, who was fantastic. Let me just do what I wanted to do, except for when it came to manufacturing, there were constraints. Mm. And I didn't understand how I'd only worked on bits of fabric I'd bought and done it myself, but I didn't obviously know the kind of commercial constraints of things. So he guided me through that, but it sold well, but it wasn't what I wanted it to be.
Mm.
I wanted it to be on sackcloth, it was on cotton and it was chintzed, and all the effects that I had quite literally got were sort of trompe l'oeil onto the fabric. You know, it was a sort of a false effect. And so it didn't really satisfy me.
So was that the beginning of a sort of frustration developing?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you couldn't have complete control over the whole process?
Yeah.
Because, reading about you, one could say that you could be labelled a control freak in the nicest possible way, in that you want to be, what it is you want, and you want to damn well get it.
Mm-hmm.
And working for other people that have different agendas going on, maybe to save money, or it's not quite what they want. Mm-hmm. So, 8 years is quite a long time working out there in the jungle.
It was quite a long time. Well, I did, about 2 years at Osborne Little, and then I went to America because I was married to somebody from the Royal College, a product, a car designer, and he was posted to the States. So that pulled me away from Osborne Little.
Right.
So I had no choice, really. I had to... So I did my collection there, started a second collection, and then we had to move. So that cut that off. So what I did in California was actually completely unhappy there because I didn't know anybody.
So it was sort of like starting over, or not
on my own,
on your own,
in a room in a house, a very nice house, but we had a sort of studio room in on Malibu, looking over the beach. It was completely alien, the whole culture.
So even the sort of different weather conditions and colour, they didn't colour, have an effect
I
on.
Didn't, yeah, and I'm just, I, you know, where's the town centre? You know, I didn't know.
So unlike David Hockney, for example, who fell in love with the sky and the and stayed there for 30 years, it didn't really do very much.
Except, no, it did do something, actually. What it did was I couldn't, this thing about what's authentic and not authentic. Mm. If you, I remember going to thrift shops and I didn't know what was the genuine 1920s flapper dress or what might have been the cast out of some television or film they'd done for The Great Gatsby, Gatsby last week. Yeah. You know, I found that fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember going into the canyons behind where we lived and wanting to see a cowboy, a real rodeo rider, you know, and thought I saw one and went into the Airstream caravan and realised it was the set, the people, the start, the crew, the film crew having their, and the extras having their lunch. Mm. And it was a film, it wasn't the real thing.
Right.
So this whole thing
surreal.
Of kind of slightly ambiguity.
Mm. So how long were you in America for?
Just under a year.
Oh, so not that long. Short stay. And you came back then?
And I came back, but while I was there, I built up a portfolio of work on paper.
Mm-hmm. And so had not been shown to anyone? You'd just been
I did little trips.
Developing.
So I went up to New York and then I came back to Europe at some point during that period. And I went and I sold it. So I'd sell it to people like Calvin Klein, Perry Ellis, to British Home Stores, Laura Ashley. I mean, a host of people. And I did it all myself for selling.
Yeah.
It wasn't that successful. I mean, it was okay, but it was an awful lot of hard work and I didn't sell as much as I thought I should have sold. And then I went to First 11, you know, Jenny Frean, and I didn't do very well there either. And I think my heart was always really in, it was just, my designs to me were almost like a blueprint for the actual finished product.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit, to me, it was a bit like making a cake and not only not seeing it rise, but not even tasting it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, in my head, have this idea of where this should go.
Yeah.
It was never just a flat design.
Mm.
It was meant to be
just the beginning of the
beginning of the, and I could even go as far as to visualize how I should see it woven or printed or and I could see how it would work if it was wrapped around a chair or whether it was wrapped around a neck. That was really important to me. So
you were able then after that 8-year period of being in America for a bit, being here, working for different companies, selling yourself, you managed to start your own company. How did that happen?
That happened out of complete utter frustration. I was a trip to New York and I won't say who it was with, but it was a very big brand, and they kept me waiting in I was there for 4 hours with all the sort of hope that they brought in the sort of cruise wear department and the evening wear and the this wear and the that wear, and they didn't buy anything. And I wasn't very well. I remember I was exhausted. I was like carrying these portfolios around and for some reason, I probably had a bug and I was tired. And I actually fainted after one. I mean, I was ill, you know, and I didn't feel very well at all. And I fainted and I thought, I've just had enough of this. And I knew of Patricia Belford, of Belford Prints, because I'd done some special commissions for Christian Lacroix and Anushka Hempel when I left college, just before I started Osborne Little. I had a few little commissions, you know, like you do sometimes when you do a degree show. So I went up to her and I did those, and she was really, really helpful, and they invited me back up for a weekend to just experiment. They do this with people. They say, come up, and even sales reps of Liberties, they'll say, come and have a go at, you know, printing so you understand what you're selling or, you know. So I went to one of these weekends, and Ron Smart, the owner of the factory, said, for God's sake, just stop it, get out there and sell it. And I thought, oh, God, help. As I had this, in fact, it was that design over there on the chair. And so I thought, well, I can't do fabric because you have to have metres. I knew from Osborne Little you have to do minimums of 200 metres and warehouse it. And so I thought, oh, I'll do scarves. It's a really easy vehicle. It's just a rectangle, you know, and I will go and see Harrods or Liberties, you know, find out who the buyer is. And so that's what I did. And actually, it was Caroline Charles, in fact, was the very first person I saw. And I went in with all these options, different colourways and different techniques. And she said to me, Nisha, can you come back when you've designed your collection, please? Anyway, so Caroline Charles and Harrods were my first order. And then I funnily enough, there was a woman living above my mother who knew the person who ran a trade fair in Paris, a static show like London Fashion Week in Paris.
Yeah.
It's called Tranoi.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, I think she'll like your work very much. Let's send it to her. So I sent it to her, and then literally 2 days later she said, I've got you a little booth, which is really lucky because normally there's a really long waiting list. And she squeezed me in. And that's when Bergdorf's and
Barney's. So this is a sort of trade show where you literally are setting out your stall and people come and have a look and then
place orders.
Yeah.
So then it was, oh, Christ, how am I going to manufacture this? You know, because you have to buy the cloth and everything. And
so you were really on your own.
Completely on my own.
Yeah.
Then at that time, my then boyfriend, now husband, and mother both said, right, well, we've got to get you organised, Nisha. So put some money into it to do my first run of scarves.
And then we hired a
student, an intern from a business school in Paris, because Stefan was knew, had more contacts in Paris. So we got a young intern who was really sparky and great with numbers and, you know, so a businessy person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the two of us for a long while.
How long has the company been going for
My
now?
My last collection was 1996.
96, so really, you're very well established now. Mm. And how many people have you got working here?
Oh, now it's less than I used to have. I've got two full-timers.
Yeah.
And then I have a freelance who comes in.
Yeah.
And we're now looking for an intern, actually, to help with, because we're doing an e-commerce shop. We're looking for somebody else to come in and help.
Mm.
And the person who we had at the beginning would be perfect.
I mean, having run a business myself for a long time, how do you divide up your time between, you know, your very necessary creative time and the sometimes all-consuming and often distracting business side?
I'm not very disciplined about dividing time up, and I wish I was.
Mm.
I'd like to be the sort of person who'd say, right, you know, from 9 till 12 I'll just do designing and I'm not going to talk or see or look at anybody. But it doesn't work like that. And maybe it's also something to do with, you know, I've got children as well, so I'm sort of juggling.
That's tricky.
You know, and I've got a husband who lives in Paris during the week.
Yes.
So I'm you know, I can't be like that.
No.
I have to juggle.
Yeah.
So,
but do you have the business side? Is that sort of supported? Are you supported on the business side by somebody?
Now it's so easy because all it is invoicing my royalty payments.
And that's that.
And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, contracts, licensing contracts.
So in terms of marketing and all that's all taken care of by the companies
Yes. I mean, what I think is really important, and actually, you know, I quite like doing it because it's all exciting, you know.
Yeah.
It's lovely to be able to get your things out there on the marketplace. So I'll be really supportive of the press the PR agents that they have, and let them use this house for if they want to show. I mean, I'm quite proactive in all of that.
Sure.
Because I think it's, you know, it's so important.
And how many collections are you expected to? I mean, what is the norm for? I know in the world of fashion there's a rigid sort of structure, but how is it in the world of textiles?
Well, there isn't really. I mean, luckily, that's a wonderful thing. When I was doing the fashion cycle, it was a nightmare.
Because that really would seem to me to be an enormous pressure.
It was hideous, as I'm sure, you know, Georgina would say the same. You know, we were exactly the same. Doing the same. Well, in fact, we were competitors. I mean, she was doing it before me.
Right.
But we went through the same hideous things with the scarves. Having to do two collections a year and having to keep it fresh, and not having any money and all of that. But with furnishings, you don't. I can do one collection a year for the furnishings.
Right. Seems to me, your work is now applied to a whole vast range of things, which I've seen here today. I mean, from, you know, the ceramics, pots, teapots, saucers and so forth, and I've seen tiles.
Mm.
And there are book covers next to me here for Virago Press, where they're using your designs on the covers as backdrops. So you seem to... Are there no areas that you wouldn't consider?
I mean, it's not really... It's not the area that is important to me. It's how it's done.
How it works.
And sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So you could say, you know, for example, there are certain... this is what, going back to the Ottoman Empire things that I saw, the thing that I loved about it was the styling of things.
Mm.
I like the whole circle of taking a pattern and saying, oh, that would look really nice if it was pigment on a linen. It would look really rustic and simple. But my goodness, it would be really nice if it was a cut velvet with a bit of metallic gold thread. It would look really opulent.
Mm.
And hey, they can do both.
Mm.
It's a bit like, you know, dressing up. Sometimes you want to wear your jeans and T-shirt, and other times you could glam up. And it's the same with some, you know, different things work for different designs, and that's what I really love, the translation. To me, the translation and the styling of the pattern onto end product by means of technique is to me, just as important, which is why I did my business.
Sure.
That's why I didn't stay in a studio or sell my designs on paper.
Yeah. And what about modern technology? I'm not talking about the vehicle to allow your work to be translated into print quickly, as we've seen in your own studio. Now you have a fantastic printer, you have CAD machines, but you still work very much hands-on at a drawing board with gouache paints, and it hasn't changed for hundreds of years.
No.
But what about exploring new fabrics, textiles, technology that can be embedded into fabrics? Are you interested in that sort of thing? You know, I mean, I think that these days there are things that can light up, and there are things that can that can change colour through temperature and all those sort of things.
Well, only in partnership with somebody who knew how to do it, because,
right.
I mean, that's something I actually really realised. One of the things when I left the Royal College, I thought, well, how am I going to do without my print table and all these different techniques that I have at my fingertips here that I can do? And actually, I realised quite quickly when I worked with Osborne Little, it's always changing.
Mm.
When I go up to my wallpaper factory to do my wallpaper, there's always some new ink or some new paper or some new machine.
Yes.
And it's the Mr. Wonka in the factory that's job to do that.
Yes.
So as long as I'm working with the best Mr. Wonkers.
Yeah.
And if there was a sort of light, you know, I don't know, if somebody like Helen Story came and said, oh, let's do and put a pack, I'd love to, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's in partnership with.
Yes.
And I'm about to do something with a lighting person.
Oh, you are?
With pattern. And absolutely.
That will be interesting.
I think that's the. I love that. I love working with different craftspeople. I mean, I don't know how to weave carpets, but my licensee, you know.
Will know.
Knows.
He knows
a
man who does.
You know, the engraved mirrors. I love that collaboration. You know, I think it's.
You, one of the quotes I found of yours, you said, I believe that decoration should have an emotional appeal. And I think, you know, looking at your work, I can quite see it has lots of different moods.
Mm.
Just tell me a little bit about that, because I think we're, you know, we've come through different phases. I mean, there was a phase where minimalism was in, and it was virtually absolutely in, and of course, there are still very well-known minimalist architects that would not probably give any of your work house room because it's too disturbing for them.
Mm.
So how do you cope with those sort of shifts in style? Because, you know, wallpaper was very out of fashion for a long time.
No,
now
is,
it's back big
yeah.
time.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. It was when I had a little shop on Chelsea Green, which was a showroom, and before I then handed it all over to Turner Gigon. And I remember I was doing the windows, decorating, and I was spending a lot of time sort of finding trims for the cushions and chairs and upholstering them. And there was a rather grumpy sales manager I had employed in the shop. And she said, you do realise you're wasting your time here. And I said, why? She said, well, you're just giving out ingredients to people for them to use in their schemes. And that was a real lesson to me. It's the designer who's going to take that and put it into some scheme and use it. And it might be in a concrete minimalist building, you know, just with that on it.
Yeah.
So I don't really, okay, when I'm designing things, I have an idea of how I see it as a mood, but I'm very aware that, a bit like children, once they leave the nest, they're on their own. And so it absolutely fascinates me when I see how different architects and designers use the fabric. And it's a real spectrum, you know, of modern minimalist to more traditional.
Mm. What's your own personal style?
A mixture.
Yeah. So you like, because I think I read somewhere else it said, I think it was a funny little question and answer thing, one of your favourite things it said, but I think it's now become evidence to why, because you have so many pressures around, is solitude.
Oh, I love solitude, yeah.
But it doesn't sound as if you get very much of it.
No, I don't. No, that's actually one of the things, as a child you asked me what I was like, I was quite introspective and
I think short-sighted.
I was
and detailed.
Very, you know,
I
was
I
not good in
that.
Groups.
Yes.
At all, I was not good in. Wasn't happy.
But know. I mean, your world now. The selling process is obviously a lot easier because you have all these licenses and connections. But that must have been quite a challenge if you're a shy person going out there and selling.
Well, I was hopeless. I was not. But I hired somebody.
Ah,
to
okay.
sell. And that was the problem.
That was the problem.
Is that, and ended up, you're paying people to do something that you're not very good at doing yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to direct them. Yes. So it wasn't even a case of, I mean, I know exactly, I couldn't have gone around selling because I wouldn't have never been able to design.
Yeah.
But it was that whole thing of that I was still in charge of that person because I was employing them.
Yes. But it's trying to implant your emotional being into them. Yeah. So.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm much happier now with, I love the idea of all these, you know, rug companies and all the licenses are somewhere else.
Yes.
My little hub here, my little womb here. And,
it's perfect. And, so what things still inspire you? Obviously, I can, you know, I can see from what we've been talking about the things that have inspired you, but where do you get your, I mean, I'm thinking, for example, who is the predictor? Is it Lee, what's her name? Lee
Edelcourt.
Yeah. Who's, I remember from a long time ago getting those books, those prediction books, which Bloom. And they seemed to be very exciting, even for a graphic designer looking through. I got kind of turned on by texture and colour and so forth. How do you recharge your batteries in terms of being inspired?
That's really easy. I mean, in that I think that by osmosis, you realise, you sort of pick things up. So I think that, okay, yes, I make conscious decision to go and see exhibitions, and I'll go to maybe an antique fair, or I will, if I'm travelling, I will pick up on things, whether it might be a sweet wrapper, or it might be a toothpaste tube, or it could be an exhibition on, you know, I don't know, you know, Fortuny or whatever. It's a real mixture. But what I do is, like, now with the iPhone, take lots of photographs, which really helps.
Yes.
I am very good about recording things that I get inspired. I mean, I make, sometimes I just remember them.
Yes.
But the iPhone records it. But I'm very good at, I think I'm quite methodical in that I collect my ideas and I organise them on my pin boards or in my sketchbook. So it might be I'll tear something out of a magazine and put it there, and then it goes through a sort of sorting process.
Mm.
So I'm sure most visual people are. You look at something and you like it, and you in a second you pick up on it.
Mm.
But it takes a while before anything's going to happen to it. It goes through you.
Yeah.
You think about it. You sort of live with it somewhere in your head. But when it comes to the nitty gritty of actually putting the design down on paper, because it's got to go off to the manufacturer to be made, that's the time when the processing goes on.
Mm.
And it will start with, I'll have an atmosphere of what I want to do, which is usually something different to what I did last time, or consequence of, or an offshoot of something I did. I mean, I find that too many ideas at the beginning is the problem.
Mm.
So it's a sorting process. Mm. I have to really marshal and organise myself.
Mm.
And I literally do it in columns on the walls. I mean, I get tape and I do compartments and I label and I give them working titles and I'll doodle ideas with them and then think, I'll put a bit of that on. So it's a bit like grafting. I sort of graft one idea from one column onto another. So it's quite methodical, really.
Mm.
But at the same time, there's always a very abstract atmosphere going on, and a sort of an emotional thing going on, whether, for example...
I mean, how much, for example, I'm interested in the design process, in how much does, say, a chance encounter affect your work? You know, that you're distracted and you look away and then perhaps you see something that hadn't occurred to you. Do you have those accidents?
Yeah, no, I think it's... Well, I wouldn't say accident. I would say that...
Or you're,
if there's something nice to be seen...
Your antennae are sort of ready to pick.
I think they're probably ready all the time, and if there's something that's crossing its pathway, it'll go...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it'll just suck it in.
Yeah, and suck it in.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's really how it goes. And often some of the ideas I might have seen ages ago, and they just sit there.
Are there any, obviously the business side seems to be as you want it in terms of other people taking care of all those things that you don't want to be doing, so leaving you very much, you know, to your own devices as a designer. You're also situated in the perfect place in that your home is literally a walk across the garage, so you haven't got the tractor work in the rain and all that sort of stuff. Are there any other things of possibilities on the horizon that you would like to do that you've not been able to do, or are you perfectly content? And
I'm quite content. I mean, it's definitely taken this long for me to really find a sort of the right level of, I mean, the fact that I felt I had to have a business to do what I wanted to do is no longer the case.
No.
As long as I have people out there who want to do things with me.
Yes.
So I just, more interesting projects. I mean, the lighting project I think sounds really exciting.
And do you get an anxiety about, I wonder, how self-assured you are now in terms of your work. Do you ever get anxious about, well, then maybe they won't want me next year? Or
Yeah.
So you've got that driving you at the back of you.
There's a definite drive in me. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm sure you asked the same question. Why, like you said at the beginning, why do we do what we do, and what have we got in us that makes us do what we... I mean, I know that the drawing thing was a refuge.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, my mother was stylish and all this, and my stepfather, well, that came later, although much, much later. I can't really count that in, but he introduced me. I mean, he loved painting, and but I think that I had this drive to sort of prove myself, definitely.
Mm.
Well, you've psychoanalyze about that if one wants to, but I don't think we really want to.
You certainly prove yourself. Okay, I'm going to end now. So, if you had to give some advice to a budding young student who, to your work as being the kind of thing that they'd love to be involved with, what sort of, because the world is
so
pretty
hard,
tough at
I
the
know,
moment.
I know.
What sort of advice could you give them to help to follow in your footsteps?
Oh,
because
God.
Yours has been quite
a
journey.
I was really lucky in that I, you know, had some bit of money to put into the first collection. And if I hadn't had that bit of money, I mean, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, one could sort of, I suppose, hypothesize about all sorts of things, couldn't one? But
did you have a self-belief at that time? Did you feel that you had something?
I think I knew I was good at art, because you do at school. I'm sure you did. I'm sure most of us, you know, you could get the art prize at school. It starts with that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And then, you know, getting a first class in, you know, Camberwell, and then getting into the Royal College. I mean, you could have all the anxieties still, despite the fact, but, you know, you can't ignore the fact that you must have some kind of talent. But I definitely had the drive. I think I had more drive than... what would I say to a young person? I would say that I think the most important thing is to really enjoy what's out there. I mean, I was very... You know, my eyes were always looking, and I used to get so excited about anything that I liked. I mean, it was like a treasure, you know, it was like sort of, you know, and I would either take a photo or I would draw it or I would get the postcard or I would remember it and it would influence my next piece of work. So it's sort of like a magpie and just enjoy it. You know, as to what you actually do with it, I think my best thing was I was very lucky to get that job, Osborne Little.
Well, you certainly made lots of things to look at here today. Anisha Crossland, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much.